Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. Welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Ty Landrum, and he is my special guest for this month. And to be honest with you, I'm excited to talk to him because our paths have crossed in Mysore, but I've never really got a chance to like really understand who Ty is. And so, Ty, I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you, Taylor. It's a pleasure.
So I just want to kind of start, just like we do with every podcast, just kind of giving like a little background of about where you were, where you're from, and kind of like, you know, sort of the background about family and high school and college and that sort of thing. Like, tell us who you were back then. That's a loaded question, right?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in South Florida mostly, at the beach. I grew up, you know, in a sort of skateboarding, surfing culture mostly. And, I went to, college at the University of Virginia. So I left, you know, I left Florida in my, I guess I was 19, to go to college.
What part of Florida?
I was from a place called Palm City, which is it's about an hour and a half north of Miami. Yeah,
okay.
On the east side. Uh-huh.
Is your family still there?
They are. Both of my parents are native Floridians. So,
wow.
Yeah, they'll never leave.
even
though the state is sinking into the ocean, you know, they're gonna be there to witness that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have two sisters. One a little bit older and one a little bit younger. We're all pretty close. So, and one of them, my older sister lives in Florida still, and my younger sister lives just a few blocks away from me here in Boulder.
Oh wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so why did you go to Virginia? Like what called you to Virginia? I mean, it's a great school. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. You know, it's a great school, and you know, it was far enough away from Florida. I wanted to get away and see more of the world. And, I was in high school, I did some wrestling. And okay. I was recruited to Virginia for wrestling, actually. So that was the main thing. Yeah,
and I never pictured you as a wrestler.
Right. So I did that just for 1 year. It was it was Division I wrestling, college wrestling. It was like super intense, and I did enjoy the intensity of it, but it was also there my first year of college that I was introduced to philosophy, and I read a few things studying philosophy that really gave me some profound shifts in consciousness, and it really sort of reoriented me. And so after the first year, I decided not to continue with the athletic program, but just to sort of focus more on learning. And so that's what I did.
So what were you reading?
Well, you know, the thing that really turned me around, was reading, The Meditations by Descartes. And there's a sort of series of, reflections on the similarities between waking states and dreaming states. And there's, in the meditations, there's this this sort of argument that there's no way to tell that our waking states are any more veridical or sort of, you know, representative of actual reality than our dreaming states. There's no features of waking experience that give us any kind of certainty that what we're experiencing is, you know, is any more real than what we experience while we're dreaming. And the meditations is, sort of invites you to contemplate that and really think about what that means for your relationship to reality. And so I really, you know, I guess I was just ripe for reading it or something, but it had this really profound effect on me, which, you know, really shifted my sense at the time, you know, my very sort of narrow sense of my relationship to the real. So,
wow. And that sounds like that kind of started you on the path of like figuring out what that is too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it was like, you know, looking down a rabbit hole, and then at that, it was, you know, through that experience, I decided to really take the leap. And so I studied philosophy, you know, I started studying philosophy at that point, and also reading Plato and Kant were the other two figures that really influenced me in a major way. And, so I ended up, you know, going to graduate school in philosophy and, you know, eventually getting a PhD from the same school. So. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because, you know, I read your post, I follow you on social media, and I'm like, you know, I'm like a very practical black and white kind of person, you know, and I read your post and I'm like, oh wow. Like there's so much depth to the things that you're saying. And it really makes sense. Like I did not know that you, studied philosophy. And so like that kind of brings it into full view of like, oh yeah, that's why it's so, I mean, you've spent time actually contemplating these ideas.
I've spent time contemplating those ideas, and I've spent a lot of time sort of cultivating, you know, the ability to express ideas. That was, I think that was like maybe one of the most valuable things that I got from studying philosophy formally.
So when did you make the shift of like into yoga philosophy?
Well, I started, let's see. So I went to Seattle for a while, and I did a master's program there at the University of Washington in Seattle. And then, I moved back to Virginia to go to the PhD program. That was in 2005. Yeah. And it was right at that moment where I made the move back to Virginia that I started yoga, and I started studying yoga philosophy, you know, almost immediately after getting into yoga. So, but you know, my training was in sort of Western philosophy. But I was interested in like theories of human development, theories of, you know, I was reading these different philosophers reflecting on sort of what the potentials are for the expansion of human consciousness and, you know, what it means for what it might mean for human beings to sort of realize their higher potentials. And those were the kinds of things that really, interested me. And so
do they still interest you though?
Yeah, absolutely. They still do. And, I mean, in fact, what really strikes me is the sort of commonalities and similarities between, the things that, you know, some of the ideas that are really sort of central to the Western tradition and ideas that you find in yoga philosophy. So I was interested in sort of, I don't know, what you might call the mystical edge of, you know, ancient, Greek philosophy. And, of course, Plato and Patanjali were probably contemporaries. At least they lived, you know, within 100 years or so of each other. Sure. And a lot of their sort of, you know, the sort of core ideas are strikingly similar. I mean, for example, there's the dialogues that Plato writes. Some of them are called the they all center around sort of dramatizations of his teacher, who is Socrates, having conversations with other people in ancient Greece, and usually they took the form of Socrates sort of, you know, massaging the minds of these people to, you know, out of states of sort of arrogance and like hubris and sort of projected knowledge into a recognition that they didn't actually know what they thought they knew, and that reality was actually more complex or more fine-grained than they previously thought it was when they were looking at it through the lens of their ideas. And so those dialogues always end in what's called aporia, which is like a state of not knowing, a state of being sort of confused, or of being sort of destabilized or even disoriented by the experience of being suddenly dispossessed of one's ideas. And that's the way that most of these dialogues end, in that state of aporia. And, you know, that same state is also, you know, what Patanjali calls Nirodha, which is a sort of,
right,
you know, a sort of suspension of ordinary ideas. And that suspension can take many different forms or many different levels of it. But it was the same basic idea that Socrates was teaching, was that you have to sort of, you know, keep giving up your projections of reality in order to be open to receiving reality, you know, more fully. And, you know, Socrates was also said to have often gone into these sort of states of trance-like stillness, and to come out of those states reporting a sort of renewed sense of clarity and of ease and of, you know, sort of perceptual acuity through those states.
Sounds like yoga.
Yeah. I think he was, you know, they were doing yoga in their own way. And I don't know what kind of practices they were doing. Nobody really knows what kind of practices they were doing in Plato's academy, in his school. They weren't written down, but there are references to practices that, and they thought that in some sense it was, that those practices, that it was sort of, I don't know if taboo is the right word, but they weren't to be written down, that there would be something sort of degrading about writing those practices down. And you have the same idea, you know, in India at the very same time. And of course the Yoga Sutra is mostly a treatise on psychology and has very little account of actual practice. And so I was always sort of fascinated at these, you know, trying to understand what it was that they were doing, and how it was that they were connecting to these sort of higher states of perceptual acuity, these higher states of realization. And also Plato's descriptions of these states of realization are really quite breathtaking, and they're sort of allegorical descriptions, as they are in yoga, because they're said to sort of reach beyond the realm of name and form, but to have a very sort of practical upshot, which is that, you know, a person who attains these sort of higher states of realization comes into some kind of intimate contact with, as Plato puts it, in a couple of places, the formless form of beauty. And a person who comes into contact, direct, unmediated contact with the formless form of beauty, then exudes that beauty through their physical and mental being, and they become then a sort of exemplar of real human virtue or realization. Wow. And that everything else, like common sense morality and so forth, is just a sort of simulacrum, is just a sort of cheap replication of what the realized being exudes sort of naturally and spontaneously.
Wow. So kind of gave me chills.
It always gave me chills too, you know, and I was always like searching for like, but you know, like feeling this real disconnection between the practice of academic philosophy as I was learning it in graduate school and the kind of experience that Plato is writing about in these dialogues, and thinking, well, this, you know, whatever philosophy was to them, that's not what we're learning in school.
Right.
None of these people, I mean, as brilliant and, as sort of fascinating as many of these, contemporary and sort of canonized Western philosophers are, it doesn't seem to me that their writings or their teachings are offering us anything in the way of like, well, how do we pursue that? How does one pursue that? And, you know,
is that where the practice of yoga came in?
That's
for
where
you,
the practice or? Of yoga came in. When I found yoga, it was just like this, revelation that from very early on, I that something inside me understood that this is a practice. This is something that you can do, something that you can, you know, with direct sort of tactile experience, that you can sort of slowly, you know, wear away at these sort of conceptual overlays to your experience and start to have, you know, greater intimacy with reality in a less conditioned form. And so I just thought it was like the most brilliant thing that I'd encountered up to that point. And I still think that.
So. Yeah. You're speaking of the yoga, encountering the yoga.
Yeah. Yeah. The yoga. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, because it seems like, you know, if you have, I mean, I feel like people that are drawn to philosophy, like have this like gnawing feeling of like wanting to know, like we're having that connection or having that higher consciousness and all of that stuff. So to actually have those practices, because yeah, you're right. Like even the Yoga Sutras doesn't have a lot of the things that you can do,
mm-hmm.
you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's very interesting that it's like you've fell into the path of yoga. And did it also, like when you first started with yoga, did it like encompass like a sitting practice too?
From very early on. Yeah. Yeah, it did. You know, I understood from the very beginning that was sort of integral to it. And the way that it was taught to me too, from very early on, my first teacher was Jennifer Elliott, who runs Ashtanga Yoga of Charlottesville. And she, yeah. Is a very old student of Richard Freeman. So she lived, here in Boulder in like the late '70s, early '80s. So, you know, when I was just a little kid, she was here studying, wow. With Bolt and with Richard before the yoga workshop had even opened its doors. So, the way of doing the yoga, was sort of in that vein, in that stream coming from, Richard from, you know, from the very first day. And that was, you know, sure. that was my first experience with yoga too. Was, you know, walking into her lead primary series class, which sounded tame enough, you know, when I heard about it, but,
it's only primary series.
Yeah, it's only primary. How hard can it be? You know, and I thought of myself as a pretty physically capable person. I was just, you know, completely floored at how wonderfully unreasonable it was that, like, what she was asking us to do, you know, it's like people right off the street. I'm like, you want us to do what, you know?
Right.
You want us to do 60 pushups? Like, that's crazy.
So anyways, that sort of this sitting practice has always been a part of it for me, and pranayama also, you know, from very early on. And I count myself, you know, really lucky to have sort of wandered right in to that particular stream of yoga. And I've just sort of followed it, and continue to follow it into the present day.
That's amazing.
So,
yeah. And so do you, what was your first experience? I mean, I know you kind of mentioned it, but like, was the primary series hard for you?
It was very hard. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was hard, and it was extremely painful. It was emotionally painful. And since this is I think it would be in line with, the sort of mission of Heartbreak Kids for me to mention that I came into yoga, not just from this sort of intellectual, it didn't just answer for me a sort of philosophical longing, but something that was profoundly emotional too. And that has sort of, I'm riffing on this because you told me that, you know, we should get into the nitty gritty personal stuff. So here we go.
Yeah.
So, part of what drew me into philosophy, that sense of, you know, wanting to understand. And I mean, when I first read Descartes and I had that sort of shift of consciousness, I felt like I had suddenly been estranged from the world in a particular way. I felt that I was suddenly, that something, some innocence was suddenly lost. And I felt as if I was sort of living suddenly in a dream world, you know, and I was, and I had been up to that point, but I think I didn't realize it until then. So that was sort of like, it was reading that suddenly really brought home to me in a really sort of profound, visceral way that most of my experience and my sense of the world was a mental projection. And I think that most of what I had done in philosophy was sort of an attempt to recover some of that sense of sort of childhood innocence and sort of wholeness that was ripped away from me, you know, through that experience. But actually, I think mostly what happened to me over the next decade of studying philosophy was that rift just became greater and greater. So that, because the sort of over-intellectualizing of reality that is encouraged in academic philosophy is anything but an answer to that existential problem, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So the problem is sort of one of suddenly feeling as if one is estranged from the, you know, from the creative forces that make one who one is, that the sort of the source of being, if you like. And I tried to use philosophy to, you know, to sort of come back around and see if I could recover some of that sense and sort of, you know, move back over that gap and not feel as if I was suddenly isolated or estranged or sort of lost in this dream world. That didn't happen through philosophy. And actually it got a whole lot worse, you know, before, because there's a period of like 10 years here before, like, the first time I read Descartes and had that particular awakening until I started doing yoga, until I found yoga and sort of understood what it was. And during that time, I think I simply became, as most of us do, as we sort of come into adulthood, increasingly estranged, and fell increasingly into a sense of isolation and a sense of sort of knowing that somehow I was estranged from the source, but not knowing how to cope with that. And at the same time, about, well, let's say 5 years later, you know, after that first awakening, I moved to Seattle to go to a graduate program in philosophy. And at the time, I was really into rock climbing, and I had a friend who had that. What he was a childhood friend, a guy that I went to middle school and high school with, and we both wrestled on the same wrestling team in high school, and then we both got recruited to University of Virginia together, and so we. I mean, so our lives were like really entangled, and we were the best of friends. And we were climbing partners also. And he, like me, didn't continue in the athletic program, but moved out of that. And we got well into climbing while we were at University of Virginia. So then when I moved out to Seattle to go to graduate school, you know, one of the reasons that I chose that particular program over some of the sort of other, you know, in more prestigious Eastern schools was that they have amazing mountains. And so the idea was that he was going to move out there too. And he was an environmental scientist, and he was doing some research in the Everglades. And he was going to like finish this research project that he was doing, and he was going to move out to Seattle about a month after I did. Well, during that month, from the time that I first moved to Seattle, before he was to move out, he had a scuba diving accident and he died. He got the bends, and so he got the bends from scuba diving, and then the next day he was free diving. And he had an aneurysm, which is, you know, what happens with the bends. He had an aneurysm just in the water. Right. So he died in the water, you know, doing what he loved, which was kind of has a certain poetic beauty to it. But in any case, I went back to his funeral for a few days, and then I moved back to Seattle. Now, I didn't know anybody on the West Coast at all, like no one. And I was just starting this new program. And I didn't tell anybody that my best friend had just died. You know, I just kind of kept it quiet and sort of, you know, self-medicated with marijuana basically, because I had no tools for this kind of emotional processing, no tools for, and really no very sort of developed, ideas about death or ways of helping me cope with death. So that was another real shift in my consciousness and in my sense of, you know, feeling secure in the world. And I had no way of processing that grief, so I just swallowed it big. And, you know, fast forward 6 years later, 7 years later, and that grief was really, you know, it just hardens you, and it closes you down if you don't go into it and allow yourself to really experience it, which I hadn't. And so it turned into a pattern of depressive states of mind. And so by the time I moved back to Virginia to do the PhD program, I was, you know, by any estimation, someone's seriously struggling with depression. So
and you had never struggled with it before?
Not before, no. But it had been, by the time I moved to Seattle, I mean, it had been, you know, the depression came on pretty, I mean, it was kind of like the grief of my friend dying just shaded right into depression and continued on through this like 7 year period. And then I started doing yoga, and it was like the very first thing I felt, you know, it was like, I started doing primary series and I just felt like I had a cinder block in my chest, you know? Sure. And I understood right away that this was something that had to be unearthed and coped with and felt. And, this practice of Ashtanga is what, and Jennifer Elliott, my first teacher, you know, that's what guided me into doing that. The practice sort of provided this safe, compassionate, open space that was also, you know, sort of had all of the sort of grit and rawness of that experience to just sort of welcome it back out into the light of day. And, you know, I was taught that there was nothing to be done about it, that it didn't need to be spun into a different story. It didn't need, you know, anything other than just to be intensely and rawly felt. And so I undertook the process of just feeling into it, breathing into it, feeling what that was like in my body. And very slowly it started to dissipate along with those depressive habits of mind. And so, you know, it wasn't a quick process.
How scary was that time though, Ty? Like, how scary was that to actually like have something like yoga to process that grief? Was it scary for you to like walk into that space? Or, you know, I mean, did you open arms like, let's do this thing?
Well, I was hitting rock bottom, you know. I mean, there were some other things that were happening, like, you know, my friend that I'm telling you about, I was always, his father was my high school wrestling coach. And he was also the one that first turned me on to philosophy. So I had a pretty close, intense relationship with him also. And, you know, in that, just a few months after I moved back to Virginia, he was, you know, I was speaking with him on the phone a lot. He was going through a hard time. I was sort of his main confidant. And he committed suicide. You know, I think he too didn't have any tools for processing grief after his son.
I mean, not a lot of us have those tools, you know?
Right.
I mean,
it's like, yeah. Yeah, so, that's yeah. Right. That's right. And I would also, the same month that that happened, that there's, you know, there's so many stories going on here. And of course I'm just following certain threads and lines, but
sure.
I had also during that time in Seattle, I'd gotten married. And I was married for about 6 years. And then, that marriage fell apart because I was, you know, mostly because of my depression. And, I got officially divorced the same month that he committed suicide, you know? And, so that was maybe like 9 months into my yoga, you know, like I've been doing morning Mysore for about 9 months. And, you know, when you first start doing it, I mean, this was my experience and I've seen this so many times in people who come to this kind of yoga, because usually they come looking for something or needing, you know, like understanding that, you know, that they're carrying this great emotional agony, you know, and that they need some way of like sorting it or like relating to it. And, you know, my experience was that when I first started doing the yoga, it got worse.
It does get worse.
Like, it's not like instant relief. It's like, okay, here's all your darkness and your demons now coming at you, you know? And so the answer to your question, was it scary? I mean, it was very difficult. Yeah. I think there was, sure, that fear was definitely part of it. But there was just so much, you know, just so much darkness that sort of, you know, that comes out of that. And,
well, did it seem like when you were practicing and you have like all of these things going on, did it feel like you were walking into a deeper estrangement, or did it seem like you were walking towards some sort of like, you know, reconciliation or something?
You know, there's some part of me that knew, and this was my point, was that I sort of hit rock bottom, you know, like there was some part of me that knew that I was going to be able to recover some sense of life, you know, from this experience, some sense of connection, some, you know, because there were glimmerings of that, you know, coming through little sort of rays of light, you know, just here and there, little reflections here and there in the darkness. And some part of me knew, you know, from almost from the very first day that, like, you got to do this every day. Like, this is, you know, you got, like, yeah. This is it, you know? And the more I went into it, the more that was just, like, continually reaffirmed, although it was so intense. And, you know, up to that point, after, you know, about 9 months, and then my friend's father committing suicide, and then there was a moment where I just really felt, and I know that, you know, you of all people are, you know about hitting rock bottom. There was this moment where I just completely hit rock bottom, and there was, you know, there was a certain evening, a certain night, a certain moment when I was completely resigned. Like, I was just ready to completely let go. And I did just completely let go. And I thought that was sort of the end of my time in this life. And
you tried to commit suicide, Ty?
I didn't try to commit suicide. I was thinking about it, and it almost seemed, everything seemed so hopeless that I wasn't really even motivated to do that. But I almost felt as if I was just going to lie down and just let go and just pass on into a different life. You know, like, I really felt at one particular night, and during that time, like, when I first got to Virginia, I just lived in this cabin, like, way out in the Shenandoah Valley. And then I would ride my bike on the highway, like 22 miles to school every day. And that was just kind of the mental state I was in. Just the isolation was somehow fit my mental state. So I was just out there, and, you know, and sometimes very dark forces would visit me and out in those mountains. And during that time, and one night, I just felt that, you know, it was just like letting go. And it was kind of like, some part of me just let go. And at that moment, I saw myself from above. I mean, I had, you know, a sort of out-of-body experience, but I'm looking down at myself lying in fetal position on the floor, just completely broken. And I felt this outpouring of compassion for that person that was lying down there on the floor. And my experience was one of just reaching down and just hugging this person and saying, "It's okay. It's not your time. You have so much life to live here. Let me help you up." And I helped myself up somehow. And, you know, that was another huge, huge moment. Another huge shift of consciousness where I had felt sort of, I really count that as the first time I felt self-compassion in the real sense. Jeez. You know, like, you know, seeing myself from the outside and going, like, all of your suffering and all of your shortcomings, because there's a lot of self-judgment in my depression. That was a huge dimension of it. It was like, it's all fine. Like everything that's happened up to this point is perfect. This is your life. This is your path. And, you know, you have no idea where it's going next, but let's go. And then I remember very distinctly, it snowed that evening, like a blizzard. And then I woke up in the morning, and I, you know, again, it was just in this cabin out in the woods, and I looked out, and the sun was coming up over this, like, deep, freshly fallen snow, and there were crystals all over the trees. And I just, like, had never felt such, you know, such a strong sense of love and gratitude for my life up to that point. You know, it was absolutely the yoga. I mean, the yoga was what was sort of unearthing all of that. In any case, a few years later, my teacher asked me to start helping her in the Mysore program. And so I started helping her. And that's how I first started teaching, just assisting her, and then teaching some lead classes in the evening. And then a few years later, I was teaching, you know, Mysore classes independently. We were like splitting the mornings, and you know, and I wrote a dissertation, interestingly, on the role of love in human development. And then, so I finished that in, so that was 2011. And then I had a postdoc at the University of Virginia at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. I stayed there for a year, just sort of writing and studying, and mostly studying yoga philosophy at that point. Sure. And then I came to Boulder in 2012.
Why did you go to Boulder? Was there a reason?
Yeah, you know, I was like, I really wanted to get out of academia at that point, but it was like, it had been my life for so long. I knew that yoga was, that I just wanted to be completely steeped and immersed in yoga, because I already was. And it was like, up to that point, academia was like the vehicle that it had allowed me to do that, to just spend all this time contemplating and practicing. And, you know, I mean, of course I was like, I taught philosophy while I was a graduate student at University of Virginia, but I was able, once I got into the yoga, I was able to sort of fulfill all of those academic responsibilities, and still have just tons of time for practice of all kinds, you know, vasana, pranayama, meditation. So I was just really steeped in that the whole time. And the next step was, the next step on that path was to become a professor. And that is an extremely demanding life. And I was worried that I wouldn't be able to practice as much.
You're too much out of the practice. You don't want to go
there. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I just wanted to keep doing yoga. So I was like meditating a lot in this place in the Shenandoah Valley. I just had this like favorite rock that I would go to in the afternoon. So after my postdoc ended, I was actually offered an assistant professorship position at University of Virginia in their philosophy department. And
that's big, yeah.
And so it was like such an honor, and I really love the people there. And I love Charlottesville. I love that whole vibe of that whole valley. And so I was leaning toward taking it. Then I was meditating, and I was like, well, what? You know, is this the right thing? And it suddenly just came into my head that I was to go to Boulder. And it was such a strong feeling. And I'd never really quite had that, such a strong feeling that I was suddenly to like uproot and leave somewhere before. But I was like, well, okay. I mean, I have all summer. I'll go to Boulder. But for whatever reason, I felt that I should like completely move out of my house. So I sold my things and I moved out of my house, and I was in Boulder 6 days later. And I came to practice at the yoga workshop. I came like early in the morning. I took a red eye flight because it was cheap, you know. So I came early in the morning, and I came to Boulder, and I, you know, just to practice yoga at the yoga workshop. And I walked in, and there was this, you know, beautiful young woman was, you know, the yoga workshop. Maybe you've never been to that old space, but it's just a big rectangle. You know, there's no locker room. There was no credenza. There was no reception area. You just, you know, it's like a proper Ashtanga shala. You walk in and, you know,
walking right into the shala.
Yeah. You just, you open the door and people are sweating on you. You know, it's like that. Right. So you open the door, and this woman was, you know, practicing really close to the door, and she just stood up and looked at me, and we both just stood there looking at each other speechless. And she said, "I know you." And I said, "Hi." And then we both had this moment of like self-awareness and like immediately recoiled from each other. And you know, I just,
who wasn't,
and she's my wife now.
How did she know you though?
You know, she said that she had come to her, so her sister lived in Charlottesville, and she's a very introverted person. So this was curious behavior, you know, But we did meet once before. She had come to a Mysore class that I taught, like, you know, maybe 9 months earlier. I actually didn't, and I'll never live this down, but I didn't actually remember that.
Don't tell her.
She knows. Yeah. She could tell, you know. But so I met her, and then I met Mary, was teaching the class. And so I thought, you know, I didn't know why I was there, but at the time I was really studying Ayurveda a lot. And so I thought, you know, in that 6 days before I left, I was like, why am I going to Boulder? Why? So I was like on the internet, and I was looking around for like some Ayurveda training or something. And I found one that was starting like a week later. And, you know, I didn't know the woman who was teaching it. I didn't know the program. But anyways, I enrolled thinking like, oh, you know, this isn't a kind of an amazing program. Maybe that's the reason I'm going. So I enrolled. So I was enrolled for that program. And I went, you know, there was like the first module of it happened that week. And so I practiced at the yoga workshop. I left, I went to a cafe. The woman who's now my wife, she was there, and she was like, wow. Oh, hey. And I was like, hey. And so we sat down and had coffee and talked for like an hour and a half. And then I was like, oh, I've got to go to this, you know, I've got to go to this training that I'm here for. So she gave me a ride there. And then, you know, I took the training, and it was okay. It was, you know, there were some good teachers there, but it somehow I felt like I wasn't in the right place. And then when that 1 week module ended, during that week, I should say, I ran into Cheyenne, she's my wife. I ran into her every single day in different places all over Boulder. Like, it was totally uncanny. And I was thinking, like,
that is crazy.
At first I was like, oh my God, she's going to think I'm like following her, you know? And then after a few more times, I was like, wait a minute, maybe she's following me. <You know? laughs> that training ended up getting canceled for a lack of enrollment. And so I went to, I was like, oh, like I was like so deflated and thinking like, oh, this is strange. You know, I had this like vision that I was supposed to come to Boulder. Maybe it was just like a projection, you know, maybe it was just hubris. And so I was kind of crestfallen. And I went to the Mysore class, and Mary was teaching, and she goes, oh, how's your Ayurveda thing going? Well, you know, actually it got canceled. So, and it was going to be like I think it was like a 6 week thing, 2 month thing, something like that. So I had planned to be around like most of the summer. And she said, oh, well, you know what? A spot just opened up in our month long intensive. And that starts in 2 days, and we'd love to have you there if you want to do that. And I was like, oh, amazing.
Talk about like the flow state or something. This is just like, yeah, God's grace, yeah, or whatever. Like, come.
And so I ran into Cheyenne, you know, like a few hours later at some random place in Boulder, like in the supermarket or something. And I told her I was taking the training, and she was like, oh, really? I'm enrolled in that too.
Oh my God.
So anyways, that was the first time that I ever actually met Richard Freeman in person, was 2 days later, you know, in that training. And, you know, so that's where, and I had heard so much about Richard from Jennifer, and, you know, why it didn't occur. I mean, I didn't even know about their month long training. I was never really one to do anything on social media or even spend very much time on the internet. So like, it was not even on my radar. I didn't even know about that training. Kind of walked into it. And so I took it. And so I had this wonderful opportunity of like, you know, sitting at Richard's feet and hearing him give these philosophy talks every day. And for me, that was just it. I was just like, I mean, it really struck a chord really deep in me, the way that he was talking about yoga and its possibilities, and the way that he was describing, you know, the experience of practice and the places that it led to, and the sort of the warmth and the the brilliance and the compassion that was all just sort of saturating all of what he was saying. I mean, I was just like, just completely, completely taken in. And
I was in a workshop with him in Columbus, and I tell you, I had the exact same experience. I was like, wow, just I mean, 3-hour workshop, and Ty, it felt like 3 minutes. And I was just completely like drawn and like grasping for every single word that was like coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
It was quite staggering, actually.
Yeah, so. I'm glad to hear that. I can relate.
Yeah.
So yeah. For me too, that month went by. I felt like, you know, half an hour had passed and the month was over, and I was like, I'm not leaving. You know, I'm staying here. Yeah. And so, you know, and of course, you know, during that month, I fell in love with Cheyenne. And you know, I rented a room after the intensive was over for a month. I stayed there twice. I stayed with Shay and all the rest of the time. And then by the end of that month, I was moved in. We were engaged 2 months later. We were married by the end of the year. So it was, and then
you were supposed to go there. That's for sure.
Yeah. You know, and then, but then the next spring Mary and Richard also, they asked me right after the intensive, when they heard that I was going to stick around, if I wanted to teach there. So I accepted, and I turned down that assistant professorship position back in Virginia just to stay there and teach, you know. And by the next spring, we were thinking about like, well, you know, if this is going to be my life, you know, I can't just teach a couple classes every day. I need to like, you know.
And dive in the deep end.
Yeah. So we thought like maybe we'd go open a studio like up in the Northwest or something. Cause I really do love that sort of the mountains there and the rainforest. And so we told Mary that we were thinking of, you know, just we were having coffee with her and just kind of asking her for her blessing or something to open that space to move and open a space. And she went white as soon as we brought this up. And I was thinking like, oh no, she thinks we shouldn't do it. You know, and cause you could tell there was something on her mind she didn't want to say. And she was kind of like stumbling over her words, and we were just like devastated, you know? And then finally she was like, well, we were thinking that, you know, maybe you two would just like take over the yoga workshop. You know?
Wow.
Just, you know,
yeah.
My heart skipped a couple of beats, and so anyways, we did it.
What did you get?
Yeah, we did it. I mean, and here we are.
The rest of history, right?
Yeah. So crazy. It's been...
I'm interested.
It wasn't my dream, but it was much better than anything I dreamed.
Yeah.
So.
For sure. I'm interested to, like, you know, I mean, that's a... like fascinating story, and like thank you so much for like sharing like your
I can't believe I just did that on something that's going to be public.
It was beautiful, man. And I like
you.
But I have to ask, like, you know, and I think I already know the answer to this, but like, what calls you to your mat today though? Is it still the processing of those events or
I would say that at, you know, at first, if yoga was first about trying to sort of, you know, overcome these depressive states, that's long since faded. Yeah. And I would say it took about 5 years to where I was like really like not so much stuff, not like susceptible to depressive states. And it was a gradual process. It was like it was just like, you know, like less and less time spent in those depressive states. And then after 5 years or so, I just wasn't falling into them anymore. And then by 7 years, I just didn't even have those traces of depressive thoughts in the background of my consciousness anymore. They just vanished. And at the same time, my fascination for the sort of just the sort of exhilaration and the sort of expansiveness of the conscious states that I was coming into in yoga was something that just kept drawing me forward. And I started just being completely astonished by, you know, what it could feel like to have a relatively healthy mind. I mean, it was far more rich and just interesting than anything that mesmerizing really than anything that I had imagined. And I started to feel myself as being part of, you know, as being fully immersed in this process of unveiling, this process of, you know, liberating myself from projected vikalpas or mental constructions, and what is sort of revealed by that, the sort of fascination of seeing more clearly and the fascination of feeling into an embodied existence with a sort of renewed and recalibrated relationship to those mental states, is that fascination is what keeps drawing me back to the mat every day, along with, I think, just like a sense of gratitude for the opportunity to be alive and to experience the wondrousness of this existence and the expansive reaches of a consciousness that's, you know, not so confined and isolated to a sort of conventional self-projection. So it's and then, you know, in my really best days, I simply feel that this sort of dance of Shakti, this sort of love of consciousness for the, you know, for the felt expression of its own creative potentials, is just something that is acting through me and something that I'm participating in as I practice, or, you know, just as I go through life. And so on my best days, just to show up and participate in that dance is what wakes me up early in the morning with great delight.
Jeez. So awesome, man. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show and
like you
said, yeah, like it was great to hear and learn a little bit about you. And, you know, I appreciate you sharing all those details. I think everyone needed to hear that. I think it's very important. So,
well, thank you, Taylor. And thank you for all the work that you do, all of the, you know, the vulnerability that you have so courageously put yourself in, the way you have shared your story too, has been a real inspiration to me. And I know for countless others around the world. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. So thank you for being on the show, Ty.
Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.